notably defensive in response. One defense widely used is that the project does not single out Jewish institutions because less than 30 of the relevant institutions can be considered Jewish. However, the key point to be clear about here is that these are not groups that relate only to the Jewish faith or Jewish community as a whole. Rather, everyone that is mentioned is directly involved in pro-Israel advocacy. They should all, therefore, be described as Zionist, not Jewish groups. The fact is that lists, diagrams, and briefing on the many ways in which Zionist groups ally with imperial powers and subvert anti-racism is essential. It is perfectly legitimate to target Jewish groups that support Zionist crimes, just as it is to target Christian groups that do the same. The mapping project, to its credit, is already doing that. The best response to this from BDS Boston should be to intensify the targeting of Zionist and pro-Israel groups so they can be more effectively seen and held accountable. The project should be rolled out in all 50 US states as well as internationally. In the end, of course, like all other racist groups, each one will have to be dismantled as part of the process of liberating Palestine.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And he's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. We're also joined by Ibrahim Abul Esed. Ibrahim is a UK-based Palestinian researcher and activist. He received his master's degree in Middle East Studies from Leiden University, specialising in the formation of Palestine since the fall of the Ottoman Empire. He's also a supporter of a organisation called the Palestinian Youth Movement, a transnational grassroots organisation that's expressed its support for the mapping project. Welcome to the show. David, I wonder if we could start with you. I mean, the maps and images that were produced by the mapping project, they reminded me a bit of the kind of material that you've produced in the past, and that also drew a lot of attention from the Zionists, didn't it?
Yeah, they referred quite often to spidery diagrams, as if this was some kind of illegitimate or conspiratorial approach to showing how power relates to power. And of course, it is not. It's a well-established social scientific technique. It's called social network analysis. Indeed. And it's a way of showing the way in which organisations relate to other organisations, either through funding, through personnel, or through shared activities. And we produced a diagram way back, 2013, I think, on the British Zionist scene. And they threw their hands up in horror and said, these are all Jewish communal organisations. Mm. And of course, they are organisations which sometimes have the word Jewish in their title, sometimes claim to be Jewish communal organisations and to represent the whole Jewish community. But they don't. And they are all, without exception in terms of the ones we used, Zionist organisations, the pro-Israel organisations. Some of them are formally part of the Zionist movement and others are just pro-Israel groups. And the same is true of the organisations here. I had a look through, I didn't expect anything else, but I had a look through to make sure on the mapping project. And of course, every single one is very, very clearly footnoted and linked and described. And the links that there are between them and the Zionist movement and the way in which they pursue pro-Israel policies are very clearly illustrated on the website, and that's just as it should be.
Mm. I mean, Ibrahim, what's your thoughts? I mean, why do you think there is a need for a project like this?
Well, the significance of the Boston Mapping Project is that it lists at least 460 institutions as well as organisations ranging from universities, arms companies, as well as media outlets that support Israel's occupation in Palestine. To those unaware, Israel's occupation in Palestine has lasted for at least 74 years and has claimed the lives of countless men, women and children, and continues to claim the lives of countless men, women and children, including the elderly, the physically and mentally disabled. Yes. The significance, in my opinion, of the Mapping Project lies in its ability to show us how Zionism, an ideology, can materialise within an institution. So those that are hearing this word Zionism for the first time, Zionism is the belief that Jews, no matter where they reside, have the historic right to reside in Palestine, whereby they receive more rights than the indigenous Palestinians that have resided there for generations. Mm. So the Mapping Project, as David Miller has said, echoing his words, is very important in understanding the nodes, the corporations, as well as the institutions that support Israel's ongoing occupation in Palestine. Mm.
I mean, David, do you think this attempt to make Zionist organisations and their activities more visible is likely to encourage or discourage the pro-Palestinian movement?
Well, there's two sides to this. On the one hand, we can't effectively campaign against pro-Israel groups if we don't know who they are. So it's fundamental that we understand that there are pro-Israel groups throughout this country, throughout Massachusetts, throughout the whole of the US, and indeed all over the world. But we don't really usually have any awareness of them. In this country, there are literally thousands of Zionist and pro-Israel organizations. Now, no one in this country can name them all. There's far too many of them. But once you start to name them, you start to say these organizations live at this address, they are funded by these other people, they have this much money, this is what they do, then people can start to say, well, is that right? I didn't realize that that was happening. So it's fundamental to campaigning against Zionism in this country, which, of course, is a fundamental prop to the occupation of Palestine over there. But on the other hand, what's said by some people in the movement, and we saw that in some of the film, is that, well, this is too close to home. These organizations have Jewish in the name, and we shouldn't really be targeting those organizations because it could result in Jews being targeted. Well, you know, on the contrary, this is not about Jews. It's about pro-Israel organizations, and it's about the politics which they pursue. Any organization which pursues pro-Israel politics, whether it's got the word Jewish in its title or not, is fair game for the pro-Palestinian movement. And that seems to me to be the key thing here, that these organizations have to be understood and known about in order for us to target them.
Mm. I mean, in a bit, why do you think like the Palestinian youth movement and organisations like, you know, Samidun have come out in support of the project? I mean, what's the motivation behind them doing that, do you think?
We must look at these movements themselves, the entities of these movements, what are they made up and the purpose. When we look at Palestinian youth movement as an example, it is a transnational movement made up of members from the Palestinian diaspora. Those very same members will carry out projects and campaigns designed to support and call for the human rights belonging to the Palestinian people. As history has shown, one of the biggest threats to such campaigns has been the Israeli lobby. By understanding the connections that the Israeli lobby have, for instance, within Boston, and the relationships they have with other cultural academic institutions, betters the individuals within PYM, betters the individuals within the Samadul network in terms of understanding the political climate in which they operate in, and so how to hold Israel effectively accountable.
I wonder, David, as well, whether you could say anything about the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, have they been involved in trying to undermine this mapping project? And perhaps just say a little bit about what the Anti-Defamation League actually is for our viewers.
Well, the ADL has been involved. We saw a little bit of that in the film. They are central to all of the campaigns against the Palestine Solidarity Movement. They were set up almost 100 years ago now by an organisation called B'nai B'rith, which is remains a global Israel lobby group and is formerly part of the Zionist movement. And it was set up to target anti-Semitism. It's the Anti-Defamation League, so it's against the defamation of the Jewish people, that is anti-Semitism. But very, very early on, in the 1930s, and certainly by the 40s, even before the creation of Israel, it was spying on Arab-American groups, including nascent Palestinian groups, and giving information about them to the FBI. Then, since that period, has collaborated over the decades with the FBI, has been involved in spying on all sorts of activist groups, including anti-apartheid activists in relation to South Africa. And so this is a spying organisation. It collaborates regularly and routinely, as the declassified FBI files show, with Mossad. Indeed, collaborated with the forerunner of Mossad before the creation of the State of Israel. And so it's effectively Israel's cat's paw in the US. And, of course, it condemns any sign of pro-Palestinian activism as anti-Semitism, because that is the weapon of choice of the State of Israel in its foreign policy objectives. Just accuse all of our critics of being anti-Semites. And that's the weapon they've developed over the last 20 years, and it's at the forefront of their repertoire.
Yeah. I mean, Ibrahim, I mean, perhaps you could say a little bit about some of the organisations that have been identified in this mapping project, and also tell us, you know, why is it important that we know about them?
So let's take three organisations that were identified within the Boston Mapping Project: Elbit Systems, the Ruderman Family Foundation, and, as David Miller has mentioned, the Anti-Defamation League. When we look at Elbit Systems, for those that are unaware, Elbit Systems is one of Israel's largest private arms companies. They create the drones that are used to survey and attack Palestinians. They market their weapons as battlefield tested. Now, I'll ask you, Chris, the question: who are they battlefield tested on? was it on the 66 children that were murdered within an 11-day period that took place in the month of May in 2021, or the 39 women that also too were murdered? Another organisation worth mentioning is the Ruderman Family Foundation. The Ruderman Family Foundation, despite also making sizable donations to Zionist organisations, Shira Ruderman is on the board of the Friends of the IDF. The IDF were responsible for capturing the lives of at least 500 children within one summer in 2014, specifically in Gaza. Lastly, the organisation also worth mentioning is the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League have worked multiple times to quell any form of Palestinian activism that is taking place within America. In Boston in 2018, in Boston in 2021, they attempted to limit any form of pro-support, whatever we may find towards the Palestinians. It's also worth mentioning that in 2018, we saw the Great March of Return happening in Gaza, where paramedics such as Razan al-Najjar, journalists such as Yasser Murtaza, as well as children such as Ahmed Mseba Abu Tayyur were murdered by an Israeli sniper. In 2021, as we already mentioned, we saw at least 260 Palestinians murdered within an 11-day period. Yes. So when we look at the role played by the Anti-Defamation League, it is clear that within both years they have attempted to silence any form of Palestinian activism. But in addition to that, they have also been responsible for passing anti-BDS, or at least attempting to try and pass anti-BDS resolutions within the state of Massachusetts. Yeah. So it is fundamental that we know what these organizations are in order for us to hold them accountable to their connections with Israel's occupation.
Notwithstanding the attack by the Zionist movement against the mapping project, do you think it's another indication of the growing strength of the worldwide resistance against Zionism that a mapping project like that has actually been formed?
I do. I think that it's a new front, isn't it? I mean, it seems to me that the Palestine Solidarity Movement in this country, in the US and other places, has tended to focus on what's happening in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, the human rights abuses, the murders, the discrimination, the ethnic cleansing. And that's right, we should focus on that. But they've been reluctant to focus on the way in which those activities are supported in the US and in the UK by the infrastructure of Zionism. And so it seems to me that we don't liberate Palestine only by liberating Palestine in Palestine, but also by removing the props which allow the occupation to continue. And they are the Zionist organizations which exist. So the fact that we've now got something like the mapping program project in Massachusetts, and there are other similar projects underway elsewhere, is the beginning of showing the public in these countries what the Zionists are up to, and therefore the beginning of bringing that to an end.
Well, let's just pause there for a moment. Well-grounded research underlying the mapping project.
The mapping project stands accused, including from supposed allies, of targeting Jewish groups, even of potentially endangering teenagers. But are any of these charges valid, or do they simply provide a clarifying moment revealing weak, confused allies who objectively side with the forces of Zionist oppression? Let's look at the worst of the allegations. Zionist groups like the Union of Jewish Students, UJS, which is formally affiliated in the Zionist movement, have typically lied about the project. UJS President Joel Rosen tweeted that the project's targets included an organization for Jews with disability, the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies, the Jewish Arts Collaborative, and the Jewish Teen Foundation. Similar criticisms were made by supposed allies of boycott, divestment, and sanctions on Zionism. Ariel Gold wrote that the project literally targets Jewish teen and youth organization. We should all fear a massacre of Jewish youth as a result. A massacre of Jewish youth? For mentioning that a group with the word Jewish in its title defends the crimes of Zionism, the absurdity is extraordinary. But what is the link between these groups and Zionism? Well, the Jewish Teen Foundation of Greater Boston is a Zionist group. Run as a project of the Hebrew colleges, which specifically states it's rooted in the Zionist movement. It's financially supported by Zionist foundations and run propaganda sessions to radicalize young people to support the racist ideology of Zionism, as in this event in May 2021. Or take the Jewish Arts Collaborative, which promotes the Zionist entity and whitewashes the reality of the subjugation of the Palestinians. As well as Zionist funders, it is directly funded by the Israel consulate to pretend that hummus and falafel are Israeli cuisine. What about the Harvard Center for Jewish Studies? Not only does it attempt to provide specific legitimacy to the mythological underpinnings of Zionism and has ties to Israeli universities complicit in the occupation, it also maintains connections to the Zionist student group Hillel and the extremist sect Chabad. Overall, the mapping project is performing an extremely useful service in making visible the hidden connection of the groups in the US with the crimes of the occupation regime. The sooner it's rolled out all over the world, the sooner it will be able to contribute significantly to the liberation of Palestine. The sooner we will be able to dismantle all Zionist organizations, every single one.
David, the arguments used against the project seem to be drawn from the same playbook that was used against your analysis of Zionism, don't they? I mean, what do you think's going on here?
Well, we know what's going on. This is not just what happens when there's a controversy emerges. This is a global playbook developed by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the Ministry for Strategic Affairs in Israel. I mean, they roll out their strategies amongst their groups. The groups are all coordinated, and they learn from each other on what to do. So what you do when someone criticises a group with the word Jewish in its title is you say, oh, it's just a Jewish group. Mm. It's not a Zionist group, except, of course, when you look at its constitution, you find it is a Zionist group, as we saw in the case there of the Hebrew College, which, you know, openly states that it's rooted in the Zionist movement. Yes, of course it is. Yeah. These are Zionist organisations. Let's be clear about that. They're not organisations for the whole of the Jewish community. They're for a specific political tendency within the Jewish community, which is a racist tendency, mm-hmm. which depends for its very existence on the ethnic cleansing, the continued occupation and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Mm-hmm. So this is a playbook. We're being played here. And people shouldn't be fooled into thinking, oh, these people might be upset because we call them Zionists. They're proud of being Zionists. Mm. They're proud of it. And we should be proud of pointing out that they're Zionists, and that's a racist ideology.
No, indeed. And also, when you point out some of the interconnections, global interconnections, you're often accused, or one is often accused, of indulging in conspiracy theories, aren't you? I mean, it's...
It's crazy, isn't it? I mean, there's no acknowledgement that actually research... It's a legitimate activity
Indeed.
Of social
Indeed.
Scientists. I Indeed. Used to be a full-time social scientist
course,
before
yeah.
they signed
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
No conception of that at all. They instead want to say, oh, it's our Jewish right to have a fond feeling for Zionism. Mm. Well, you know, that's okay. Have a fond feeling for the Zionism in your heart. But the actually existing Zionist movement, that must be ended.
Indeed, indeed. Abraham, how do you respond to those that say, well, you know, kind of projects like this encourage attacks on Jewish people?
The American Jewish Committee in 2021 recently released an article whereby they questioned American Jews in terms of the threat of anti-Semitism. Where does it come from? Does it come from the left or does it come from the right? And nine out of 10 respondents said that the attacks on anti-Semitism, anti-Semitic attacks carried out in America, tend to come from the far right by a majority.
Yeah.
Not from the BDS campaigners, not from the left, not saying that it doesn't happen, but by majority... It is carried out by far-right neo-Nazi groups. And one thing that we must make evidently clear is that the mapping project was not created with the intention to map Jewish institutions and organizations. Majority of the institutions and organizations mapped in the Boston mapping project are non-Jewish organizations. Mm. As David Miller said, it is these organizations that have ties to Zionism. This is not an attack towards Jews as a result of their religion, but more... preparing the information that we need towards challenging Zionism in order to uproot its occupation in Palestine.
Mm. I mean, what do you think this says, David, about the unity of the struggle against Zionism, this sort of mapping project?
Well, I think it shows that there is a sort of infrastructure of Zionism, that the Zionist movement has its own infrastructure around the world. Especially in the US and in the UK, but many other countries too. But also, the interesting new thing I think that it shows is the intersection of the Zionist movement with other institutions of US imperialism, as they put it, but also other oppressive domestic institutions in the US. I mean, the most obvious one, which is in the project, is the connections between the Anti-Defamation League and the local police forces. Now, of course, this became a big issue, with, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement and George Floyd, where it became apparent that many of the police forces engaged in killing black people on the streets had been getting training or advice from Zionist groups, including the ADL, but not limited to the ADL. No. So there is, of course, those particular questions as well. And it's a question of how different sorts of oppression are actually, in the end, linked together. And that's a really very interesting and useful part of the project.
No, indeed. And I understand that Ibrahim, you've been working and looking at Zionism within the Goethe Institute recently. I mean, what did you find?
Well, to those unaware, the Goethe Institute is seen as somewhat the cultural arm of the Federal Republic of Germany. The Goethe Institute has recently signed an initiative alongside 30 other cultural organisations condemning the BDS movement, specifically saying, quote unquote, "We reject the BDS boycott of Israel." The Goethe Institute, who is expected to invite British Iraqi rapper Loki, as well as Palestinian activist Mohammed Al-Kurd, cancelled their performances. What we see in the Goethe Institute is nothing new, however, this anti-BDS trajectory that we're seeing throughout German society. In 2019, the Bundestag had signed a resolution titled Resisting BDS, which condemned German public bodies from providing funds to organisations that are calling for the boycott, divestment and sanctions against Israel, who was recently regarded and seen as an apartheid state carrying out apartheid against the Palestinian people by Amnesty International. But we must understand, when we look at such initiatives, when we look at such attitudes accelerating, we see the Zionist, we see a pro-Zionist agenda being pushed more and more throughout German society. Mm. We see it happening not only on a localised level, but also on a top-down level. This empowers us to, again, understand the type of political climate in which we operate in and how to, again, effectively challenge Israel's occupation as a member of the diaspora.
Indeed. Well, thanks very much indeed, Ibrahim, for your contribution today. And thank you, David. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there now, as unfortunately we're out of time. But thanks for joining us. We'll be back next week with more investigation and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme.
In the limelight.
German institutions repress Palestinians and supporters of Palestinian rights using legal harassment, smears, censorship, and violence. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Ali Abu Nima, journalist. This article is published under the heading Deutsche Welle illegally fired Palestinian journalist. German court rules. Here's the details. A court in Germany has declared that Deutsche Welle unlawfully fired a Palestinian journalist based on false accusations of anti-Semitism. Maram Salem was among a group of Arab journalists fired by the government broadcaster following an official smear campaign accusing them of anti-Jewish bigotry because of comments or criticisms about the fake regime of Israel. Recently, the labor court in Bonn ruled Salem's dismissal to be invalid. The Facebook post she was accused of were not anti-Semitic, and the termination was unlawful, the court stated during the hearing, according to a statement provided by her lawyer, Ahmad Abed. Salem explained that she has long been an advocate for women's rights, human rights, and animals' rights, and the accusations hit her hard. She called on Deutsche Welle to take responsibility, publicly apologize, and retract the allegations. The statement adds, the court threw out the anti-Semitism allegations of investigators Ahmad Mansour, Sabin Losester, and Beatrice Mansour, the statement says. Ahmad Mansour, a Palestinian-German psychologist with close ties to the Israeli lobby, the Sabin Losester, a former German justice minister, were commissioned by Deutsche Welle to investigate alleged anti-Semitism at the channel. Mansour's anti-Muslim, anti-Arab, and pro-Israel views have made him a darling of German media and state-funded institutions. In February, Deutsche Welle fired Salem along with several other journalists based on their reports. Deutsche Welle, which masquerades as a champion of free speech and a free press, had tried to portray Salem's mention of illegal Israeli occupation as anti-Semitic, according to the statement from her lawyer. The verdict shows that the smear campaigns against Palestinian women like me or Nemi Al-Hassan can no longer succeed, Salem said, adding, it was clear from the beginning that I am an innocent. Al-Hassan is a German journalist of Palestinian ancestry who had her science show cancelled by another broadcaster, Ron Funk. Al-Hassan's supposed transgression was liking Instagram post on the account of Jewish Voice for Peace, a well-known U.S.-based group that campaigns for Palestinian rights and opposes Zionism, the Zionist regime's state ideology. The Bonn Labor Court has made it clear that the strong accusations of anti-Semitism against Maram are without any basis, lawyer Abed said, adding, Deutsche Welle should now protectively stand in front of Maram instead of giving in to the agitation. The European Legal Support Center, a group that fights anti-Palestinian repression through litigation, hailed Salem's win as the first victory in the Deutsche Welle case. Farah Maragha, a Palestinian-Jordanian journalist fired amid the anti-Arab witch hunt, is also suing Deutsche Welle. Her case is still pending. German institutions repress Palestinians and supporters of Palestinian rights using legal harassment, smears, censorship, and violence. Germany's commitment to supporting the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians is so unyielding that it permits the Israeli regime to kill German citizens, including children, with total impunity. effort in a hopeful sign that democracy and human rights may be possible, courts have been pushing back against anti-Palestinian repression. In another recent defeat for official censorship, the city of Stuttgart acknowledged that it has illegally removed information about a local Palestine support group from its website. The city has complied with a court ruling and reposted the information.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran-Russia relations with Russian Ambassador to Iran, Levan Jagarian. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
Iran and Russia are entering into a new strategic era in their relationship. The West's sanctions and overreactions, and its failure to isolate Russia following the war in Ukraine, has resulted in a strategic reorientation of Russia towards the East and South, which includes Iran. Iran itself is taking full advantage of a new emerging multipolar world order and declining US power, and is enhancing its strategic relations with emerging powers from around the world, from China in East Asia to Venezuela in South America. After all, Iranians witnessed the failure of the JCPOA process and the failure of the nearly 30-year attempt by certain Western-oriented Iranian elites to create rapprochement with the West, only to be embarrassingly rejected by the US itself. Iran is confidently pursuing its national interests with its non-Western neighbors in Asia and friends and allies around the world, and closing the book on strategic rapprochement with the West. After a period of naivety and sophomoric false hopes about the West and America among Iranian and Russian elites in the 1990s and early 21st century, everyone in Iran and Russia has now witnessed the fundamental enmity of American and Western elites to the very existence of an independent and powerful Iran and Russia, which can effectively contain, roll back, and expel America from Eurasia as it tries to maintain its fast-fading claims to global hegemony. Iran and Russia have made a good start into this new strategic era. However, a number of issues remain to be resolved, particularly in the field of trade and economics. Once these issues are resolved and Iran and Russia sign the strategic agreement that is currently being finalized, Zbigniew Brzezinski's and America's nightmare scenario of the strategic alignment of Iran, Russia and China will be complete, moving the world faster into the post-American era of contemporary human history.
Ambassador Jagarian, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As you know, our program is more of a conversation. Yeah. We want to get into the issues in a more deep fashion. We want to talk about it more from a historic, strategic perspective. And so with that in mind, there's a lot of things we need to cover in our conversation. Well, Mr. Ambassador, it seems to me if we examine this behavior after the Cold War, we see that the West, according to the old plan from the 19th century, Halford Mackinder, talking about never allowing Russia and, for example, Germany to have good relations, always having these buffer states, one time against Russia, one time against Germany. So we see that they're effectively what they're doing is they are weaponizing the most extreme chauvinistic nationalistic elements in all the countries.
Yes, yes.
So it's not the case that everybody in Latvia or in Estonia is like this.
Yes.
Or
yes.
Everybody in Ukraine, I'm talking about the Ukraine, it's not the Russian
Yes, yeah, of course, sure, sure.
So what they do is they go after the worst people, and they create an atmosphere which then causes, and all of it is to destabilize Russia. So this is
under this false, under influence of this false American propaganda, which is, I mean, circulated by Voice of America, Radio Europe, Free Europe, and BBC, so-called independent, or as I call it, Radio Yesterday, from Prague, or day before yesterday, whatever, Iran International. And
because, as you mentioned, there are different historic understandings of what happened.
Yeah.
So they are emphasizing those issues that are always anti-Russian. They're never talking about the other issues. Yes, they're never talking about that, you know, you had people like you mentioned, the Nazis in Ukraine, joining with the Nazis to fight against their own homeland and their own people. We see people attacking Orthodox churches now.
So
these are the things that maybe, as you're mentioning, it's a propaganda issue. But don't you think Russia could do a little bit more in terms of...
And we are doing more. We try to do more. And, of course, but anyway, you know, they banned all our possibilities to work abroad. And but, you know, Russia today, Sputnik, it created a huge problem for us.
Again, you're welcome to the club.
Yeah. Freedom of speech.
Exactly. Welcome.
So that's why I call them no communists. And as a former communist, I'm very happy to see a lot of new comrades.
Yes. Okay, Mr. Ambassador, very good. So let's move what we were talking about previously. So you see the future of Russia in this new... First of all, how do you see this new multipolar, this new emerging global...
Americans must forget about their dream to be to establish a unipolar world.
Right.
China, Russia, Iran, and other friendly countries will do their utmost to resist, and we are in favor of a multipolar world.
Exactly.
And it's reality, an inevitable process. No other choice.
It's interesting you mentioned that. You know, Spidir Brzezinski, in his final book, he talks about that the worst-case scenario...
Yeah.
For the Americans is is the strategic unity between China, Russia, and Iran. He very cleverly doesn't mention India because they always want to use India as a wedge in Asia. But so it's very clear when somebody like Brzezinski talks about this, then this becomes clear to us why they are doing these things.
Sure.
So on the one side, they are pressuring Russia with Ukraine. They did it also the coup attempt in Kazakhstan, I think it was.
In January,
they're doing all these things. In West Asia, they're pressuring Iran with Israel, with all this.
Taiwan.
Of course. And in East Asia, they're pressuring China with Taiwan and with the Quad and, you know, the
troops. AUKUS.
Because a lot of people don't realize, you know, the American troops that are in Korea, they're very close to Beijing.
In South Korea,
they're very close to Beijing. This is not something that's because of the North; it's because of China. Okay, so with that in mind, let's talk a little bit about this new emerging strategic relationship between Iran and Russia. There's many aspects to it. It's at the beginning of it. I think it was a good start. I remember we had the trip by President Putin to Iran a number of years ago, which was a very good, successful trip, and where President Putin and the leader of the Islamic Revolution had a good meeting. President Putin gave as a present one of these old Qurans that was in Russia, which was very nice. I believe that maybe at that point we see the beginnings of this issue, this kind of newer relationship emerging. Of course, at that time, we didn't have the issue of JCPOA. We didn't have the issue, or we had it, but it wasn't as prominent, maybe. We didn't have the issue of the problems that have occurred after the special military operation. But then with the new administration in Iran, the 13th administration, we had President Raisi going to Moscow. We had the Minister of Energy coming here. We had the recent, Russian National Day here with the Minister of Oil here also. So if you could please give us a little bit of an insight into what will it take, what is happening and what will it take for us to get to this, inshallah, as we say again, this time where we can sign that strategic agreement as Iran signed with China, as they recently signed with Venezuela. What are the issues? What are some of the barriers? From your perspective, what do we need to do in terms of economics, security, culture, whatever it is that you think that should be mentioned here?
First of all, thanks for this very interesting and a good question. I have been serving here as ambassador for more than 10 years and a half.
Yes.
And for me, it's a big honor to represent such a great country like Russian Federation and such a great country like the Islamic Republic of Iran. You just mentioned President Putin's visit to Iran. I was witnessing and participating in this visit three times, 2015, 2017, 2018, and I was present in his meetings with His Excellency, the spiritual leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I would like to express my respect to His Excellency. And I was witnessing the very warm atmosphere, very friendly. And such good personal relations between our leaders, they are very helpful for us.
Yes.
Diplomats, high-ranking officials from both countries to fulfill, all the tasks we have got, instructions from our leaders. It's very important. Now, with the 13th government of the Islamic Republic of Iran, we can say that we have opened a new page on our bilateral relations. And initially, the Iranian government, President Raisi, expressed his will to develop much more relations with neighboring countries and with eastern countries. The same are for us. So we have similar goals, ideas. And you mentioned this exchange of delegations between the two countries. From the very beginning of the year in spring, a lot of Iranian high-ranking delegations visited Russian Federation. And Mr. Oji was there, Minister of Transportation was there, Mr. Rustam Qasemi, Vice President Surena Sattari was there. And finally, on the 25th of May, a huge, big Russian delegation headed by Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak visited Iran. And he had many meetings here, very fruitful. And he was accompanied by six vice ministers of different ministries, economic, financial, transportation, atomic. And we will continue our consultations on different levels to develop our fruitful cooperation in mutual interest. I'm very, very, very optimistic. In autumn this year, we will hold the next session of our Joint Economic Commission in the Russian Federation. Now it's our turn to host it. I do believe that it will open new prospects for our bilateral relations. Last year, the volume of our trade was $4 billion. It's nothing.
Yeah.
Taking into consideration our capabilities, it's nothing. I mentioned $4 billion, but we will do our utmost.
Yes.
To remove U.S. dollars from our bilateral trade, not only with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And we'll do our utmost to use as much as possible our national currencies,
yes,
which is very important. And we will help us to bypass all these sanctions, illegitimate sanctions. But in terms of sanctions, they have imposed sanctions against Russia, but it was for the first time against Soviet Union. Jackson Vanik.
Yes. Yes.
But we will never ask them, please lift the sanctions. It's up to them. If they want to lift sanctions, they are welcome. If they don't want to lift the sanctions, we will impose counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. Sanctions, counter-sanctions. It is a lose-lose game. But it's up to them to decide.
Mr. Ambassador, it's interesting you mentioned the trade. We had one of our guests in the previous programs, in one of our previous episodes in this program, we had Professor Sergei Glazyev, who is a famous Russian economist. He was also advisor, I believe, to the to the presidency, and he very nicely and very technically explained that they are working in Russia on a plan to have a international trade currency to replace the dollar.
Yes, yes, yes.
Not to replace the national currencies. In fact, the national currencies can be the backing of this international trade currency. Again, something that is proposed by Russian academics. And also using the vast natural resources of Eurasia, of Russia, Iran, China, and other countries who want to join as a backing for this to replace the dollar. So this issue that Iran has been talking about for years, because we understood the difficulty of being living under this dollar hegemony and not being able to, you know, do the most basic things.
Unfortunately.
Yes, and we had recently also an interview with Professor Duhan from the UN. She's from Belarus.
Yes.
Talking about one of the main things in her report was the fact that this banking sanctioning and the sanctioning of and needing to use the dollar is an issue. So, in other words, what I want to hear from you, maybe if you can say it very clearly or very without, you know. So the goal or the plan for the Russian Federation is to move away from the dollar.
Yes. We want to remove dollar. We try to our utmost to do that. But it's their initiative.
Right.
Yeah. They decided to steal our money.
Exactly.
As well as they decided to steal your oil.
Exactly.
Don't surprise.
So this ruins their own credibility because nobody then trusts putting the money in those banks.
Yes, no trust.
They shot themselves in the foot, as they say.
Yes.
They shouldn't.
I'm sorry, you mentioned the issue of treaty between Russia and Iran.
Yes.
We've got the draft last year.
The strategic agreement.
Yes, we work on it, but it's a little bit long process. But we will try to speed it up, because we must ask the opinion of Russian different ministries.
Exactly.
Inside foreign ministry, outside foreign ministry. It's also always on the agenda of our bilateral contacts. And last time when Mr. Amir Abdullahian, foreign minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, talked to his Russian colleague, Mr. Sergei Lavrov, he also touched upon the issue. And we are working on it very hardly, and we are in regular contacts with our Iranian friends.
It's interesting you mentioned that. We had another interview. I'm sorry I keep mentioning other interviews, but about Russia, we had actually quite a few interesting interviews, both with Foreign Minister Amir Abdullahian. In the interview, you also mentioned the relationship with Russia, but also with former Iranian ambassador, Mr. Sajjadi, who was a former Iranian ambassador in Russia. And he, because he's worked on this issue a lot, he talked about that the Iranian and Russian economies are very complementary to each other. On the one hand, we have a very powerful oil and energy sector that the cooperation could be could literally change the entire global energy markets if there's a cooperation. In terms of technology, both countries very advanced in these areas, not necessarily needing the West to give them any technology, and there could be a lot of things. In terms of security, we talked a little bit about this. I think this is something that we don't mention enough, but it's good if we mention it, that we had a very successful security and military cooperation in Syria.
Yeah. Yes.
That, you know, we have to say this. Iran and Russia defeated the Takfiris.
Thanks to us.
To the terrorists. Together.
Thanks together.
Yes.
Russian and Iranians,
exactly.
First of all.
This is something, you know, because we have this problem in Iran. I wanted to also get your opinion on this, that we have this old tradition in Iran of anti-Russian.
Yes, I know. I know it very well.
Yes, I
feel it.
Of course, there is a history for a lot of Iranians as it relates to the Tsarist Russian era,
as it
relates to the Soviet Union. These are not things that we are denying. Just so that people who are listening know for sure, my great-grandfather was killed in the war with the Russians. So it's not something most Iranian families have these issues. But the issue is that Russia is different. It's not the Soviet Union. It's not the Tsarist Russian era, but we still see that there is any excuse that they can use, whether it's, you know, the Minister of Oil standing this way, or you standing there.
I'm standing this way.
Yeah, exactly.
Or this way.
Exactly. Is there something? Do you think that is the Russian Federation? Is the Russian embassy? What should we do to work on this issue? I'm saying this. You know, connecting it with this very successful year-long cooperation that we had, where we gave a lot of... sorry, I need to mention this. This idea, for example, Shahid Soleimani, General Soleimani. So one of the things that he did in Syria is he led the operation to free the Russian pilot himself as the commanding general. You know, these are important things. These are not small things. What can we do to mention the reality of what it is today, as opposed to the propaganda that they're doing?
You know, you just quite correctly mentioned that there are some people with anti-Russian sentiments. Of course, they have the right to have their own opinion.
Yeah, of course.
And we cannot impose by force our opinion. They have their understanding, we have their understanding. And the best way is to meet with each other and discuss.
Yes.
Discuss. But it was in the history, in the past.
Exactly.
We can't live only with these thoughts which are connecting to the past. We must look in the future, but and to the nowadays, what's going on. And you know, in terms of JCPOA, we always were standing with Iran. And right now, do you remember this resolution, anti-Iranian resolution,
yes,
condemning Iran,
which
was quite unnecessary.
Yes.
It was a very wrong decision, and who voted against? Russia and China.
Exactly.
That's why the question is to those anti-Russian people. Why do you keep silence?
Of course.
Please.
Yes.
Tell something. And we will continue to support our Iranian friends to get out of the deadlock. But now we cannot mediate between Iranians and Americans like it was before. Now we don't have contact with them.
Yeah, because the Americans cut
Europeans.
It.
Yeah, they cut. But anyway, it's not...
Ambassador Ulyanov was...
Very fruitful,
yes.
Very useful. And we sincerely try to be helpful. That's why I'm very, very sorry that they don't want to accept it. They don't want to accept
it. Right. They don't want to accept the reality of what it is.
Yes,
they're stuck
yes.
in the past, like you said, they're stuck in the past.
And yeah, they yes. are under huge influence of this anti-Iranian radio, like I mentioned, BBC Farsi.
Yes.
My best regards to them. Radio Dirus, best regards to them. Yes. Iran International. The fabrics who create yes. or produce fake news.
They're lying.
Yeah.
It's lies.
Yeah, and lying. And because, you know, my president said that Americans managed to create a huge, huge empire of lies.
Yes, yes, I read. Yes. That's what it is.
And they continue to lie, and it's very counterproductive.
I think this goes back to what you were talking about in terms of the Europeans not defending their pragmatic interests. So,
sorry, unfortunately.
So we see the same thing maybe in Iran and Russia sometimes, that there are pragmatic interests. It's in the real interests of Iran and Russia. And people forget, Iran and Russia are neighbors. They're not.
Yes.
It's not like Russia is not the other side of the world. So we have the Caspian Sea between us, but we're neighbors in terms of maritime neighbors. We have, you know, how far is it from Anzali to Astrakhan? It's not that far. We can do a lot of things there. We have the corridor going. So it's in our interest to, particularly given the hostility that we're experiencing and this irrational hostility. It's not something that you can say, okay, you know, we can understand everybody has their own interest. It's this, like I said, I believe it's this essential... being essentially against the existence of these two.
But we need some more opportunities here in Iran.
Right.
To conduct our activity in cultural level.
You know, Mr. Ambassador, we're not worried about upsetting anyone.
Yes.
Please tell us if you feel that
A few days ago, four ladies, young ladies, students, came to our embassy. The ladies who learned Russian language, who like Russian literature, Russian poems, I gave them, handed over diplomas. And during our National Day, you just quite correctly mentioned Mrs. Marzia Yahyapur came here, and we asked our president to reward her with the Medal of Pushkin. Mm-hmm. President Putin signed a decree, and she was rewarded this Medal of Pushkin. And for me, it was a big honor to hand it over to her. In presence of Mr. OG,
yes.
Minister of Oil, and he's a co-chairperson of our Joint Economic Commission. So we have a lot of friends here, but we need some other opportunities. We don't have cultural center, and the agreement...
Just to explain for our audience. So countries have cultural centers in different countries.
Yes, yes, yes.
So Iran has a cultural center in...
Not only one, but they have in Moscow and some other cities have the opportunity to conduct very important, very fruitful cultural activity,
yes.
to spread a Persian language, which is very popular in the Russian Federation. Because, you know, all my staff members in Iran, in General Consulate in Isfahan, in Rasht, at the embassy, almost all of them... they have well command in Persian language, which is very important.
Of course.
Very important.
Yes.
It makes our job very easier.
Exactly.
And we also, last year in April, my Minister Lavrov and Mr. Zarif, former foreign minister, signed an agreement about the conditions of activity of our cultural centers. And we just would like to ask estimate Iranian Majlis to ratify.
So we're waiting for Majlis to ratify.
Yes, 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 yes.
Any other things that you think that we should maybe other issues from the Russian perspective that you feel are some things that you would want the Iranians to maybe.
You know, before 2018, a lot of Iranians visited Russian Federation, especially 2018, Cup World. when the Iranian team participated.
Yes.
And they managed to visit different Russian cities, even Saransk in Mordovia, St. Petersburg, Kazan, and so on. I would like to see more Iranians in the Russian Federation.
I'd so like tourism to see, in
yes,
terms of...
Yes, yes.
I would what like about Russians coming here?
Yeah, also to see a lot of Russians to come to Iran.
Because, you know, Iran is a very culturally... because Iran can never really be a substitute for some of the European countries or others, because we have our own culture, we have our own...
We have no
But in terms of culture and in terms of family trips and in terms of a family vacation...
Right now, Europe is closed for Russian tourists.
Exactly.
Fortunately.
Yes. For us also, it's better.
Yes. If they don't want to accept Russian tourists, it's up to them. It's also, they damage their own interests. That's why our tourists will go to the east. Inside Russia, CIS countries, Iran, China, India, Emirates.
Mr. Masvidov, we don't have a lot of time, but just one issue that I hear sometimes from some Iranian side talking about. They're talking about that the port facilities in the Russian side of the Caspian are not maybe... not that on the Iranian side this issue exists as well, but the idea that if we're going to have this increase of trade and relations and this back and forth, we need to work a little bit on this issue of the different ports in the Caspian. If you could, please.
Yes, I completely agree with you. And recently there was also, when Mr. Novak was here, the governor of Astrakhan region, Mr. Babushkin, and a few days ago he hosted Mr. Fattah.
Yes.
Yeah. The chief of this Mostasefan Foundation.
Yes.
And we are working on that in this regard.
Okay, very good.
Also, very important is to make some technical issues, some technical works in Volga-Don channel, which is connected Black Sea and Caspian Sea.
Exactly.
We are working on it. Yes. Astrakhan, Olya, which is also just operated by Iranian friends.
Very good. Mr. Ambassador, we're coming to the end. If there's anything else you would like to mention that we didn't talk about, please...
I would like to express my respect to the friendly Iranian people. I know that we are now Russia and Iran in a difficult position as a result of the sanctions, but we will overcome all these problems, all the difficulties working together. All the best and best regards, best wishes to the friendly Iranian people.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Until the next time.
Thank you.
Thank you. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Jagarian? It's clear that the Western reactions, sanctions, and general hostility to all things Russian following the war in Ukraine have not isolated Russia, but have in fact resulted in Russia strategically reorienting itself towards Asia and the global South and away from the West. Russia is putting all its energy in cultivating the relations it has with major Asian powers such as China, India and Iran, as well as the relations it has with countries in Africa and Latin America. Relations with the U.S. is clearly a closed matter for the foreseeable future, but it seems that Russia has not completely given up on Europe, expressing the hope that the leaders there will eventually come to their senses and defend their own national interests instead of blindly following the U.S. and pushing their societies off the precipice, citing Hungary as a positive example of a country that puts its national interests before subservience to the U.S. In terms of Iran-Russia relations, it is entering a new strategic era in all areas, with the focus on the expansion of economic relations and trade, the use of national currencies for trade, and the eventual replacement of the dollar with a new international trade currency. We are moving towards the post-American era, and a new world order where Russia will be an important pillar. It seems that with every passing day, we are getting closer to Zbigniew Brzezinski and America's nightmare of the strategic alignment of Russia, Iran, and China, due in part to America's own irrational and short-sighted policies and strategies. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.